Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, it's been a bad week to be Live Nation. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
On this week's show, the US government's legal action against Live Nation that seeks to force it to sell off Ticketmaster, and the ticket tout's plans to fight the Labour Party's proposed 10% price cap on the resale of tickets. But first, Chris, tell me something else that stood out for you in the music world this week.
Well, this week, we put another category of people onto the list of people who are pissed off by Spotify. I'm assuming you, like me, you have that list on your wall next to where you do your work. A little whiteboard with your who is pissed off with Spotify at the moment. So obviously already on there, we've got all songwriters. They're on that list. They're pissed off with Spotify. The French are quite pissed off with Spotify, although Spotify have now found a way of living with the streaming levy that was introduced by the French government last year by just passing it on to their customers. And I know they're making quite a big deal about that. It does end up being something like 6 or 7 cents per month per user. So
13 cents?
13 cents. Oh, I'm sorry.
If you're a full-on individual subscriber, it's an extra 13 cents a month.
Maybe I was thinking of the student discount. Either way, for each subscriber, it's not a lot of money for Spotify to have taken on the entire population of France. But they were already on the list. New to the list this week are the car owners of America. Or more specifically, and I must admit that the category car owners of America is a pretty big category.
That's a broad category.
I suspect the car owners of America who have a Spotify carfing device in their car category, it's probably 82 people. But what we do know for certain is they are very pissed off with Spotify because Spotify is turning off its carfing device. Now, even though we have very savvy listeners to Setlist who are constantly monitoring everything happening in the world of Spotify, because let's face it, that's mainly what we talk about on the podcast. But even they may have forgotten what Spotify's car thing was. Why don't you, Andy Malt, quickly remind us what was, and we can now talk about it, I guess, more or less in the past tense, what was the Spotify car thing?
Well, it's a device or thing that allows you to play music specifically on Spotify in your car. It's a car thing. It's a car thing.
Perfect branding by Spotify. So I guess the only reason why car thing was interesting, even though it as a device it's not particularly interesting, you know, having a device that you activate with your voice in the car, hardly revolutionary. And as we say, I'm not sure many people even bought one of these things. But I guess it was Spotify's first dabbling in the hardware market. And to date, as far as we're aware, they're only dabbling in the hardware market. So whereas obviously Spotify is competing with companies like Apple, who are primarily in the business of selling devices and then run a music service on the side, for a while we thought, oh, is this Spotify trying to do it the other way around and moving into being a company that makes and sells devices? But this in-car voice-activated listening device was pretty much the only thing they did. They initially launched it as a pilot and said, actually, this is not us moving into hardware. It's part of a research program that we're running. Then they seemed to get a little bit more excited about their car thing device and started, you know, upgrading it and promoting it. And then in 2022, they said, do you know what? We're bored of this. We're not doing this anymore. we're not selling these things. Although they did sell off the stock that they were sitting on at a discounted rate. And so then we stopped talking about Spotify car thing. But the 87 people who had bought one, some of them, don't know how many, let's say 42, are still using this device. And those people got an email from Spotify earlier this month basically saying, we are going to stop supporting CarThing in December. You will be forced to download a piece of software onto your device that will render it redundant and it will not work anymore.
Yeah. It's not just that they've gone like, yeah, sorry, we're not going to support this anymore, but, you know, use it for as long as you like. They're actually making them not work anymore.
So the people who still have a CarThing in their device who paid $89.99 plus shipping and tax if they bought it in the initial round, or $50 plus shipping and tax if they bought it once they were discounted. Some of those are quite pissed off that this little device will basically stop working later this year. Some of them pointed out, could they not allow you to download a bit of software that basically would unlock it from Spotify? So you could just use it as a hands-free voice-activated device and connect it to other things in your car. But Spotify don't seem to be very keen on that. So, on our list of people pissed off with Spotify, we are adding CarThing owners in America. And so pissed off are at least some of these people that they have sued Spotify, seeking damages for the loss they incurred by buying what the lawsuit says by this time next year, or by the start of next year, will basically be a $100 paperweight. So we're not going to go into this in any great detail this week, because we've talked far too much about Spotify pissing people off on recent editions of Setlist. But we just thought we'd mention that there is an extra group of people to add to your list of people pissed off by Spotify, so that your list, like my list, is fully up to date.
But as you say, no more talk of Spotify on this week's Setlist. That is a Setlist guarantee. Later on, we'll be looking at more of this week's most interesting music industry news stories, including the US court's agreement to fast-track legal action against efforts to ban TikTok. But first, we mentioned briefly in last week's episode that we were expecting the US Department of Justice to launch legal action against Live Nation. And at that point, we didn't have a lot of information about all of that. But now that lawsuit has been filed, so we do, and it's a big one. So as expected, the Department of Justice accuses Live Nation of anti-competitive conduct and has asked the court to force the company to sell off its ticketing business, Ticketmaster, and possibly even more. This kicked off what, it has to be said, has not been a great few days for Live Nation and Ticketmaster, with further litigation and a massive data breach in the news this week as well.
Yes, it's been a tricky week for Live Nation, although possibly a good week for Live Nation's lawyers, in that plenty to keep them busy. Not the in-house lawyers, but the lawyers who are charging by the hour. Possibly a good week. But let's start off with this Department of Justice lawsuit, which says, in its opening statement, that Live Nation is, and I quote, a monopolist that serves as the gatekeeper for the delivery of nearly all live music in America today. The legal filing filed by the US government runs to 128 pages. Did you read it all, Andy, from beginning to end?
Yes.
Every single sentence?
Yep, sure.
I read some of it, I think. I can honestly say, but in there, trying to present to the world, but also most importantly to the court, proof that Live Nation is this incredibly dominant player in live music, live entertainment, venues, tours, and ticketing. It basically took Live Nation's own statements bragging to the world and to its customers and to its investors about how bloody big it is. So this incredibly long lawsuit notes that Live Nation itself claims to be, and I quote, the largest live entertainment company in the world, the largest producer of concerts in the world, and the world's leading live entertainment ticketing sales and marketing company. All of these things combined, said the lawsuit, might be good for Live Nation and its senior management and its shareholders, but they are to the detriment of fans, artists, venues, and competition.
But I guess before we get too deep into this, we should explain how we got here. to this point. So Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged in 2010, and there were concerns then that two massive companies in the live industry combining could possibly cause some competition concerns. So Live Nation and Ticketmaster agreed a consent decree with the Department of Justice, which put in place some restrictions on how the different strands of the business would work together. That consent decree was meant to expire after 10 years, but was extended for another 5 amid allegations that there had been breaches during that first term. And then it emerged last year that the Department of Justice was again investigating claims of anti-competitive conduct made against Live Nation. And that is the investigation that has led to this lawsuit.
So yeah, that's the very speedy background to how we got to this point. Let's go back to this legal filing that was submitted to the courts last week. As well as restating Live Nation's own claims to fame about how big it is, the lawsuit also runs through some key stats, trying to demonstrate that Live Nation, when combined with Ticketmaster, is an incredibly dominant company within the US live entertainment industry. It's said that the company manages around 400 artists, because that's the bit of Live Nation people often forget about. It also has an artist management division, much of which actually came to the combined company from the Ticketmaster side. We tend to think that Ticketmaster was just the ticketing company and it was Live Nation that brought everything else to the table. But Ticketmaster did have some management assets that then became part of the Live Nation group. Hence how Live Nation now manages more than 400 artists. In addition to that, the company controls around 60% of shows at major concert venues in the US, says the lawsuit, owns or controls more than 265 concert venues in North America, including more than 60 of the top 100 amphitheater venues in the USA. Plus, on top of all of that, through Ticketmaster, it controls roughly 80% or more of major concert venues' primary ticketing for concerts, and a growing share of ticket resales in the secondary ticketing market. It then claims that Live Nation and Ticketmaster have used their power and influence in the industry to the detriment of music fans, resulting in higher fees, and also, because there's no competition, particularly on the ticketing side, there is less innovation going on in the marketplace. With a lack of any real competition, the lawsuit said, Ticketmaster simply does not need to invest as much to improve the fan experience.
So calling on the court to act against this, the Department of Justice says that Live Nation should be instructed to stop acting in an uncompetitive manner, which seems like a good start. But as well as that, in its most dramatic demand, it says that Live Nation should be forced to sell off Ticketmaster. And that's at minimum, if we should note. It says sell off Ticketmaster at minimum, hinting that it possibly thinks that Live Nation should be broken up further. Commenting on the lawsuit, US Attorney General Merrick Garland said, "It is time to break up Live Nation Ticketmaster. Live Nation relies on unlawful, anti-competitive conduct to exercise its monopolistic control over the live events industry in the United States at the cost of fans, artists, smaller promoters, and venue operators."
And now, in what will be the least surprising statement of this week's set list, and possibly every set list that we do this year, Live Nation does not agree with the US Department of Justice or its lawsuit, and the company's EVP of Corporate and Regulatory Affairs, Dan Wall, has published a blog post where he pulls apart the lawsuit and disputes pretty much every allegation that has been made against the company. He also said that the investigation that the Department of Justice has been undertaking for the best part of a year now, and the lawsuit that has come at the end of that investigation, follows intense political pressure and a long-term lobbying campaign from rivals in the live sector and ticket brokers, or ticket touts if you prefer, the rivals and the touts wanting government protection for their own businesses. The Department of Justice legal filing, he went on, ignores everything that is actually responsible for higher ticket prices, from increasing production costs to artist popularity to 24/7 online ticket scalping, that's American for ticket touting, that reveals the public's willingness to pay far more than primary tickets cost. So I guess the key thing that this Dan Wall was trying to say is we disagree with all these allegations of anti-competitive conduct. Plus, if you look at the issues in the live sector, maybe ticket prices going up, particularly for the bigger in-demand shows, maybe that is an issue. But what he's saying is, even though we deny all these allegations of anti-competitive behavior, there's not even any link, he argues, between what we're accused of doing and higher ticket prices in the market, because he argues there are other reasons to explain why getting in to a superstar's arena or stadium show is so bloody expensive at the moment.
Yeah, in fact, he said it was absurd to claim that Live Nation and Ticketmaster are wielding monopoly power, arguing that Live Nation in no way fits the profile of a monopoly. He also said that beyond issues with ticket prices, when it comes to service charges that Ticketmaster charges when you buy tickets from them, they're no higher than elsewhere and, he said, are frequently lower. This lawsuit against Live Nation and Ticketmaster, he said, won't reduce ticket prices or service fees, and instead, he said, distracts from real solutions that would decrease prices and protect fans.
Now, all the arguments set out in Dan Wall's blog post that followed the filing of this lawsuit, we've heard before, because with the Department of Justice's investigation, as I say, it's been ongoing for the best part of a year now. Meanwhile, in Congress, lots of lawmakers in Washington have been scrutinising the ticketing market in general, and in some cases, Live Nation and Ticketmaster in particular. And on the back of all of that, over the last 12 months, and especially over the last 6 months, we've seen Live Nation in the US really ramp up its lobbying activities, and that includes Dan Wall writing regular blog posts. Now that the Department of Justice's lawsuit is filed and we have the allegations that the government are making set out in black and white, we can expect even more lobbying activity from Live Nation. Some of it explicit in terms of blog posts on the corporate Live Nation website and statements being made and proposals being presented in Washington. Some of it possibly more subtly, because obviously when you're lobbying, sometimes you get other people to speak in your favour. But I think there's going to be a lot to follow in the months ahead, both in terms of how other parts of the industry are responding to what is said in the government's lawsuit, how politicians in Washington are responding to it, but especially how Live Nation and its lobbyists, both outwardly and slightly more subtly, push their narrative that the allegations in this lawsuit are a nonsense. Yes, there may be some issues in the live space, but they are not the result of Live Nation's conduct. And the remedies proposed in the lawsuit, especially the splitting up of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, their argument is it won't change anything.
Now, impressively, this is not the only lawsuit accusing Live Nation of anti-competitive behaviour that has been filed since we last recorded an episode of Setlist. A class action has also been filed with the New York courts, potentially on behalf of millions of American ticket buyers. And like the government's litigation, the class action lawsuit accuses Live Nation and Ticketmaster of anti-competitive conduct, although the impact of Live Nation's dominance in the ticket resale sector seems to be of particular concern. The core allegation is that Live Nation exploits its dominance in the various different strands of live music to force venues into exclusivity deals and to prevent rival ticketing companies and ticket brokers from selling tickets to many major shows, even when Live Nation itself isn't the promoter. And where Live Nation is the promoter and the primary ticket seller, it also seeks to restrict the flow of tickets to rival resale platforms.
Now, as you say, a particular focus of this class action lawsuit is the impact of Live Nation and Ticketmaster's market dominance on the flow of tickets to the secondary market. So where ticket brokers, ticket touts, ticket scalpers, however you want to refer to them, buy up tickets on the primary sites, like the main Ticketmaster platform, and then resell those tickets for profit on one of the ticket resale sites. And that is interesting, because for many of Live Nation's critics, that actually is not a priority concern. Indeed, many of the artists and managers and promoters who have in the past criticised Live Nation and its market dominance are also critical of ticket touts and the ticket resale platforms that they use. Now, in the US, unlike in Europe, Ticketmaster is still directly involved in ticket resale. So, in a way, in America, criticising secondary ticketing can mean criticising Ticketmaster and Live Nation. That said, Live Nation has also introduced some measures in the US to restrict the unofficial resale of tickets, and when lobbying politicians in Washington has proposed some new regulations specifically of the secondary ticketing market, which those who oppose ticket touts and ticket touting and secondary ticketing more generally would probably welcome, even if they suspect that Live Nation has its own self-serving agenda with all of this, whether that's to benefit its own ticket resale services in the US or maybe to distract politicians from scrutinising other parts of the Live Nation Ticketmaster business. Also on the primary Ticketmaster site, Ticketmaster has really been pushing dynamic pricing. So there are various commercial reasons why Live Nation would want to start restricting ticket resale, maybe to an extent lobby against ticket resale. But at the same time, some of the outcomes of that would be welcomed by the artists and managers and promoters who are critical of touting and secondary ticketing. So with this lawsuit that has been filed for those artists and managers and promoters, on one level, the criticism of Live Nation's market dominance, they probably agree with, but this focus on ticket touting and the restrictions Live Nation has put in place to stop tickets flowing to the secondary market, well, it might be that some of those Live Nation critics are a little bit nervous about getting too enthusiastically behind that element of the lawsuit.
And then that last bit of bad news for Live Nation that we mentioned earlier, a group of hackers by the name of Shiny Hunters have claimed that they've got access to personal information about more than 500 million ticket buyers after hacking the Ticketmaster platform. So according to the cybersecurity news site HackRead, hackers stole 1.3 terabytes of Ticketmaster data after hacking the servers of the Live Nation-owned company, accessing the names, addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, order information, and partial payment card data of around 560 million customers. That payment data would include the last four digits of card numbers and expiry dates.
Now, this is the Live Nation story for this week, where by the time this podcast goes out, our reporting on it might be slightly out of date. As we record the podcast on Thursday afternoon, Ticketmaster Live Nation are yet to comment on any of this. However, there was a statement issued by the Department of Home Affairs of the Australian government, basically saying that they were aware that there had been a cyber incident on the Ticketmaster platform that was impacting in part on Australian consumers, and that they were talking to Ticketmaster about this. And this seems to be data from all over the world. This is a massive global hack. So I think, you know, assuming this is true and this data has been stolen, and apparently the hackers are currently offering to sell this data to you if you want it, albeit for a huge amount of money. But if all of this is true, then I think we're going to see data protection authorities and regulators all over the world taking a big interest in this, including in Europe, where obviously the GDPR regulations are still in force, and in the UK. And to just give you a indication of what that might result in for Live Nation, back in 2020, the UK Information Commissioner's Office fined Ticketmaster £1.25 million following a much smaller data breach involving the ticketing company that occurred in 2018 that affected about 40,000 customers. And this hack, if what we've been told is true, we're talking about more than 500 million customers worldwide. So as we record the podcast, we don't have any official statements on this from Live Nation or Ticketmaster. We're still figuring out exactly what has been going on. It might be by the time the podcast goes out that there are more updates on this, as is always the case. If you keep an eye on the CMU website and the CMU Daily, we will be updating you as any developments occur.
Coming up later, more talk about ticket touting, with Ticket Tout's plans to try to stop a Labour government in the UK from introducing a price cap on the resale of tickets. But before that, our news in brief section and some other stories from the music industry this week, starting with the news that the legal challenge over the proposed TikTok ban in the US will be fast-tracked so that oral arguments will begin in September. Under a law passed by US Congress, TikTok owner ByteDance has until the 19th of January 2025 to sell the app or face it being banned in the country, meaning that its legal efforts to block the ban are fairly urgent.
Sasha Lord, who is Greater Manchester's nighttime economy advisor, also chair of the Nighttime Industry Association in the UK and founder of Manchester's Warehouse Project and Parklife Festival, has said that he is cooperating with two investigations into a COVID funding grant that a company that he was involved in secured during the pandemic. That money came from a fund administered by England's Arts Council. They are investigating certain allegations about the funding application. So is the Greater Manchester Combined Authority, which is the entity to which Sasha Lord is the nighttime economy advisor. Sasha Lord put out statements about this funding application and those investigations following a report on the website The Manchester Mill, which made a number of allegations which Sasha Lord is denying. He did actually threaten to sue that website for libel, but he said he decided not to go through with that threat, and we will see what these two investigations find.
Sony Music is reportedly in talks to acquire Queen's music catalogue in a deal worth around $1 billion, so says Bloomberg. The band have been known to be seeking a buyer for the catalogue for the last year, and previously sources told Billboard that they were looking for $1.2 billion for it.
Drug testing at festivals around the UK will be more widely available again this summer because the government has issued a number of licenses to the organisations and experts who undertake this testing. This is basically the schemes where you have people on site at a festival testing drugs, either drugs that have been seized by police and security, or in some countries, actually, festival goers are able to donate some of their drugs to be tested. And what the experts are looking for is if there's any particularly dangerous or strong substances during the rounds at the festival so that they can get warnings out to festival goers and give that information, for example, to the medics who are working on site. Last year, the number of festivals that had this drug testing in place went down because festivals were told that they had to get a license from the government in order to do that testing. And a number of the festivals said, well, we've been doing this for a number of years in liaison with the local police force. We were never told we needed a license before. The government said, no, 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 you've always needed a license. The outcome of that was that in the 2023 festival season, fewer festivals were doing this drug testing. But we have had confirmation that the festivals that were affected by that last year have now got their licenses in place so that this important drug safety testing can happen at more festivals again this year.
You can read more about all of these stories and everything discussed on this week's episode in the show notes in your podcast player right now or at completemusicupdate.com. And finally, on this week's setlist, a group of UK ticket touts have committed £73,000 towards a lobbying campaign to fight the Labour Party's plan to put a 10% cap on the resale of tickets. That financial commitment was made at an event in London involving US lobbying group the Coalition for Ticket Fairness. And according to an investigation by Rob Davis at The Guardian, the recent event was attended by more than 100 people who each paid £189 to be there. And attendees heard from ticket trader Tony McGowan, who is now president of the newly formed UK branch of the Coalition for Ticket Fairness. He told them, "We are going to fight Parliament. We're going to fight government. Because if we don't, bottom line is, we're all fucked." Attendees also heard from two representatives from CTF in the US, Jason Berger and Scott Tobias. They explained that in lobbying terms, it's easier to stop a law from being introduced than it is to get an existing law changed. Professional lobbyists could be hired in the UK to try to stop any new Labour government from going ahead with its anti-touting plans, they said, but getting that kind of support doesn't come for free.
So the unofficial resale of tickets for profit is regulated to an extent here in the UK. And over the last 10 years, we've seen a number of new regulations come into force, or existing regulations have been better enforced by the authorities, often in response to politicians and campaigners in the music industry that have been calling for a crackdown on certainly the more dodgy tactics that we see in the secondary ticketing market. But actually, in the last 12 months, the demands from the campaigners have changed to be basically an outright ban of ticket touting in the UK. So basically pushing for something similar in the UK to what they've already got in Ireland that says you cannot sell at a markup a ticket for a show without the permission of the promoter of that show. The UK Labour Party, which we're all expecting to be forming the next government in the UK after the July general election that is approaching. The UK Labour Party is not going quite as far as saying, that's it, we're going to ban touting completely like they have in Ireland. But they have proposed introducing a law that would say that anybody reselling a ticket who is not the promoter of the show can only put a 10% markup on that ticket, which obviously, if you are an industrial level tout who is reselling tickets as a business rather than you're just selling on a ticket for a show that you can no longer attend, then that limit on the markup that you could put on the ticket, that basically renders your business redundant. So that is what the Labour Party have proposed, and that is what these touts have got together to try and lobby against.
Yes, neither the touts nor the resale platforms they use want any kind of price cap to become law. And in terms of the platforms, The Guardian reported that the founder of Gigsburg, which is based in Switzerland, had already committed £5,000 to any lobbying scheme. And Scott Tobias from CTF in the US said that Viagogo and StubHub are committed to the cause. Representatives from the separate StubHub International company and the US resale platform Vivid Seats, which is apparently about to launch in the UK, were also reportedly in attendance at this month's event. However, with lobbying campaigns like this, the platforms don't usually want to be seen to be leading the charge. And that's why you end up with organisations with names like the Coalition for Ticket Fairness. The touts and the platforms would rather remain anonymous. And when speaking at the event, Tony McGowan was keen to stress that anyone there who did commit to financially support the lobbying campaign would not be publicly linked to it when it went into action.
So this Guardian article was very interesting. Andy will put a link to it in the show notes. I'd suggest that you go and read it. Once we'd read it, we reached out to some of the people who have been leading the campaigning in the UK for, well, initially more regulation of ticket touting and more recently, basically, the outright ban of ticket touting. They were also very interested in the Guardian report. But actually, most of them we spoke to felt that what the ticket touts and the platforms are planning could possibly backfire. So we spoke to Adam Webb from the Fanfare campaign that has been leading the charge on a lot of this in the UK. And he said that the Guardian's report reveals the true face of what we now commonly refer to as secondary ticketing. However, he added, the ticket touts and the resale platforms coming together in this way could actually rally public support behind Labour's proposals. I suspect this self-serving lobbying effort will actually have the opposite effect, he said, adding, I truly hope that it does.
Now, Labour MP Sharon Hodgson, who is a long-term advocate of ticket touting regulation in Parliament, also reckoned that any move by ticket touts to lobby against the price cap would only strengthen her party's resolve to put it in place. She told CMU that she's immensely proud that Labour has put the ticket resale price cap into its election manifesto and said that it's unsurprising that the touts are pushing back against it. However, she added that she was shocked at Rob Davies' expose and just how sinister these websites have become in their recent lobbying of MPs and their staff.
Although the Guardian article did name some of the platforms who were either supporting this lobbying work or at least were in attendance at this event, it did also name a small number of the touts who were in attendance. That said, we would suspect that certainly when it comes to the individual touts, many of them who are supporting and possibly funding this lobbying activity probably will remain anonymous. They'll be successful in not having their names officially linked to that activity. But I think now that we know the basics of what is planned, I would expect that the campaigners, that the Fanfare campaign, politicians like Sharon Hodgson, they will be looking for any activity following the general election that is clearly being led by the touts and the resale platforms to try and scupper the plans for the price cap. And they will highlight that that lobbying activity is going on. And I think they're probably right that, you know, if that is communicated in the right way, actually, that will make a lot of ticket buyers, the general public, even more supportive of the crackdown on ticket touting, which will then make it easier for any new Labour government to push this into law through Parliament. But we do still have a general election to get through before any of this happens. So we will see as that progresses.
But that's all we've got time for on this week's set list. We'll be back with another episode next week, and you can keep up with all the latest music industry news every day at completemusicupdate.com.